Hey friends, it's Danny Morrell and welcome to another edition of the Danny Morrell Show. It's obviously been about a week since our incredible event Vision. We had 600 of you who joined us for two incredible days at the Los Coronado Hotel. And I gotta tell you, I wanted to share at least a little piece of that event to you, our followers here on our show. And the piece I'm gonna share with you is personally one of my favorites. It's an interview that I had with someone that I respect and admire, someone that has built one of the largest trade organizations in the entire country, really, Mr. Gary Acosta. And it's one of my favorite parts of Vision because it really, for me, was a moment where I got to speak to one of my mentors, got to ask questions, and you feel the crowd. The crowd really opened up during this session about what it takes to really fulfill your vision, whatever that vision may be. So I'm excited to also announce that we're going to be getting rid of all of this furniture here. We're going to be forming a professional studio. And on Thursdays, we are going to be committing every single day, every single week to bring you a live Q&A show. So I will be telling you a little bit more about that later. But for right now, if you're currently not following me on Instagram, go follow me there. Because every single morning by sunrise, I'm bringing you some free coaching, free advice. Sometimes it's just a free motivational message to get your day started the right way. So go check me out on Instagram. Just look for Danny Morrell. You'll be able to find me. Other than that, without further ado, a small piece of what was an incredible 2 days, my interview with Mr. Gary Acosta, the founder and CEO of NowRep. Enjoy. If you're serious about making a change, here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to keep your hands raised. Keep your hands raised. And I'd like somebody from the back of the room to literally just come sit next to you and sign them up. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, just sign them up. Literally, keep your hands raised. Go, Pastor. Yeah, Pastor. Preach. Fritos. Yeah, no Fritos. Okay, here's the sauna. Keep your hands up. Come on, who was it? You had them raised. You signed up already. Okay. Sign them up. Yes, you had them raised. You already signed up. All right? Awesome. Are you ready to go? You already did it? Okay, good. All right, go. There's still some of you guys. Still some of you guys. And all we want to do is help you guys. We want to help you stop picking strawberries. Is that cool? All right, let's rock and roll. Who's ready to meet Gary Acosta? Yes, I'm excited, guys. I'm excited. Somebody that I is he even in the room? Okay, somebody that I respect, somebody that I admire, a creator of what is right now, guys, the largest Hispanic business organization in the country, period, end of story. And he started it from scratch. That took a vision, that took perseverance. Please help me welcome to the stage Mr. Gary Acosta, please. I hope our microphones have not gotten jacked. They're still out there somewhere, right? Because we've lost track of them. So what Gary and I are going to, oh, there they are right there. What Gary and I are going to do, we're going to have a basic conversation. And then I have an intention behind bringing Gary here because he has created something enormous. And even though it's not a business like you're in, there's value in understanding and finding out how he took that vision from an idea, from literally an idea to making it a reality. So in a little bit, I want to open up for some Q&A.
Sure.
And I'd love for you to just kind of share your thoughts with them.
That'd be great.
So just give me some basics, right? Like how old, family, sons, kids.
How old am I? You're going to start with that?
Yeah, let's do that.
Well, I just turned 50 a couple of years ago.
Give him a round of applause. He looks young.
I have a great family that is my rock. I live here in San Diego, three children, two daughters, one that's grown up and working. One of them is a senior in college in New York. Uh-huh. And my youngest is my son, who is a star basketball player at a local high school here in San Diego. They play Torrey Pines. It's the biggest game of the year tonight. So if I seem nervous, that's why.
Okay, good. And he just got a scholarship.
Yes, he's going to play at Colorado College.
I love it. That is great. That is great. Are you ready for that, to let him go like that?
It's going to be hard. The whole empty nester thing is scary. It's scary, for me and my wife. Fortunately, we like each other, so I think we'll be
good. Okay. Okay, good. All right, good. So take me back to your roots. Like, what was your first business, or how did you get started in business in general?
Yeah, so I was born in East LA, and I went to Montebello High School, which is just outside of LA, Southeast LA. Was a pretty good student, went to college, went to Pomona College, played basketball there, played basketball for a gentleman by the name of Greg Popovich, by the way.
Oh.
Yeah, he was, it was his first head coaching job. He was my coach. So that was
Wait a minute, Greg Pop, that's from the San Antonio Spurs.
Yeah. Oh, the GOAT, as they call him now. Yeah, so he was my basketball coach in college.
Hold on, time out. You see, you can't say that and then just go, that's like saying, you know, my roommate was Kobe Bryant, and then, yeah, you know, no, hold on a second. What was that like? What did you learn from him?
Well, obviously, he wasn't who he is today yet. We didn't know better, but there was something special from him from the get-go. You realize that this guy was very intense, very focused, just went about the game very differently, had a way to get things the best out of people. That was extraordinary. I remember one of the first games I played for him, I started the game, and it got down to crunch time in the fourth quarter, very close game, and he took me out on an inbound play just underneath the basket, which is kind of a vulnerable play for a defense. And, you know, I was a little cocky back then, so I'm coming out of the, walking off the court, and I say something under my breath right by him when I walk by, and he says, "What did you say?" And I said, "I can play defense." And he says, "Oh, really? Yeah, because I've never seen that. You want to show me right now?" So literally puts me right back in the game. And of course, I never played defense harder than I did that very play.
That is awesome.
And he was brilliant that way. So that it was awesome. It was a great experience.
I love it. Did he teach you anything that you use later in life or business? Any principle that we, any nugget that we could maybe apply?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the one thing that I've always, you know, looked back and admired about him was his vision, right? I mean, this was a Division III college basketball team, and he approached that game like we were playing for the Final Four. We used to joke about the fact, we're like, "Bro, chill out, you know, this isn't the Final Four, you know." But even in a small crowd, small college basketball environment, he played like it was the NBA championship, coached like it was the NBA championship, expected that of us. And I would say, you know, nobody expected that he'd go on and be the coach that he is, which a lot of people now consider him the greatest coach that ever lived in the NBA. But I can see back in retrospect that he had that vision for himself, and it was inspiring to me to this day.
I love that. Could you guys kind of apply that, right? That's kind of like future thinking, right? Would you agree?
Yeah, okay. So I went to Pomona College. And, you know, I always thought that I would kind of take the corporate, you know, track, work for a big company and whatnot. For whatever reason, I was a science major, probably because I got a good grade in science my freshman year. And, you know, after I graduated, realized that, you know, pursuing science was probably not what I really had a passion for. Mm-hmm. I liked people. And a friend of mine invited me to check out a local bank that was hiring underwriters. And so my first job in the industry, I was about 25 years old, was as an underwriter for an independent, or I should say a community bank called Mission Viejo National Bank. And that's how I learned the business per se. And I worked in that environment, that structured environment, for a couple years. And I learned a little bit more about the business. I competed out there against mortgage brokers. And I thought at 26 years old, I could start my own business, which, you know, sometimes, you know, that naivete of being young is helpful.
Yeah.
And it certainly was the case for me. So I started my own mortgage brokerage at 26, met a friend by the name of Ernie Reyes, who was 20 years older than me, but kind of my mentor in the business, and always used to talk to me about the Latino marketplace. And we did a lot of loans for Latino home buyers ourselves. So it was always kind of a subject that was top of mind for us. But he used to say, "Gary, someday we got to do something big for the Latino community." Uh-huh. And, I used to go to business conferences like this, and I liked, you know, hearing from successful people and learning about where the trends were going and so forth. So I went to a conference in San Francisco called the Inman Conference, which still exists today. And it was all about technology and, you know, all the changes that were happening, the internet. This is like 1988, 1999. And so it was exciting because, you know, I was young and, you know, you see the change, and there was, you know, Yahoo was there and Realtor.com was just getting started. There was a company called eLoan. So I used to go and check that out. And I remember at one of the meetings that I was at, I was so filled with energy and so just overwhelmed with, you know, ambition and conflict and everything. I went for a long walk in San Francisco after the event. And it was at that walk that I contemplated NAREP. And the idea was, I had a mortgage business and I wanted to grow that, but I started to realize that there was artificial barriers out there that were keeping me and people like me from taking my business to the next level, because I didn't have the uncle that owned the community bank that said, hey, Gary, this is how you do it.
Yeah, I got you.
Or let me introduce you to my pal who works for Fannie Mae or anything like that. I didn't have those contexts. And I thought, you know what? I know there's a lot of people out there like me. And I got together with Ernie on a Saturday and we sit down and we wrote out the acronym there. And we came up with the idea with NAREP. And after we were excited about it, you know, reality set in and we said, now what do we do?
Right.
You know, sounded good while we were having a chorizo breakfast. But then afterwards, reality set in and we had to actually do something. And I can tell you that's a longer story of how we got it launched. But since then, it has been a labor of love and it has been the greatest professional experience of my life. But the greatest thing I've really, felt during the 18 years now since we started the organization was just the privilege to meet the people that I've met across the country.
A lot of people.
You know, just see that aspiration and that passion in their eyes, and to have created a platform where people feel that they actually have something that they have a sense of ownership about, that they can thrive and hopefully achieve their goals professionally.
I love it. You know, we talked a lot on day one about something called your own personal life view. It's kind of like what you see and think about yourself and what you see and think about your potential.
Yeah.
And what struck me was that by 26, you were already trying to, like, break the mold. You were already trying to do something different. Where did that come from, and what kind of upbringing did you have that led to that? Because there's a lot of confidence there.
You know, that's a really good point. You know, I see Danny up here, and I think, he reminds me a lot of myself, just his big vision. And, you know, you're a lot more talented than I was, but, just that infectious personality that you have and the ability to see beyond just the superficial is a gift. And, I was blessed to have parents that, convinced me, didn't just tell me, but somewhere down the line convinced me that I can do anything, right? And, I grew up believing that for whatever reason, not because I was necessarily better than anybody else.
No, right.
You know, I grew up in East LA, so it's not like I had all of the privileges that other people may have, whether it's financial or even educational, but I still believe that I can do anything. So the barriers that maybe a lot of people feel early in their careers, for whatever reason, they weren't there for me. And so, like I said, the naivete at times that, you don't know what you don't know, can work to your advantage, and that's what I think it was for me.
You know, it's so funny. The second thing that we said was that, our purpose here is to show our children what is possible in life. Like they guide what they think is possible based off of what they see or now hear us through our example. And that is, you guys agree, that's a perfect example of that, right? Do you guys agree? Like he just said, my parents just showed me or taught me.
They convinced me,
convinced,
and that's the difference, right?
Right.
Because parents.
That's so powerful.
I've always said that, the kids and the young people, they're going to remember what they saw and observe more than what you said, and I don't know exactly what it was that my parents, that was the tipping point, but it wasn't, son, you should do this and you should pursue that and you can do great things. Somewhere along the line, they went beyond that. And like I said, they convinced me. Sometimes it was a matter of holding me accountable to myself, whether it was a report card or a performance in, athletic endeavor or whatever the case may be. But like I said, that's the difference, I think, between some parents who just have the ability to convince their kids what is possible.
I love it. And so you started the organization. And I know you said it's a long story.
Yeah.
But you actually had to, get to work, right? Because there's one thing to have a vision, guys, and then there's another thing. You got to actually, go out and, Gary said, you got to actually go out and do something, right? So give me a little taste of it.
Well, okay, so,
Because by the way, guys, how big is the organization now? How many members?
So about 32,000 individual members, 65 local chapters.
Oh, that is awesome.
And I think we can double that in the next 3 years.
And you think you can double that in the next 3 years?
I think we will.
That's like the vision is continuing.
Yeah, you start to really hit some interesting numbers when you get up there. you know, get near the 100,000, you know,
that is big.
Member base. So that's exciting. So yeah, so we wrote down this really cool acronym. It flowed off the tongue. It was a great idea. And then we said, now what? Mm-hmm. You know, so National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals, two guys in San Diego who really didn't know anybody outside of San Diego, uh-huh. just started a national organization. So I got to tell you, at one point, I got cold feet. Yeah. I went to Ernie and said, you know what? I think maybe we reached a little bit far with this. Why don't we start the San Diego Association, see how it works. And, you know, because that's how we're taught, right? Start small, you know, test the model. And we had a mutual friend who at the time served on the board of the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and he convinced me not to go down that path. He said, there is no national organization. It's needed. If you start with San Diego, trust me, nobody else is going to follow you. Miami is not going to want to follow guys from San Diego. You got to just go for the top and build it from the top down. I said, but how do we do that? You know, somebody is going to ask the next question. I remember saying this. You started the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. That's great. You know, how many members do you have?
None. Two.
Yeah. You know, well, how large is your staff? You know, and so forth. So I said, we have to have better answers to those questions.
So that was the ego. Did you catch that?
Yeah.
Like the ego's already trying to, well, wait, hold on a second, right?
Yeah. The rational sort of ego, you know? And so the same friend said, look, this is what you need to do. Okay. He says, you just need to create a board that looks like a national organization, and people will believe that it is, and it'll ultimately become that,
right?
Exactly. He says, you don't need, you know, 1,000 members from all over the country. You need 12 people, and as long as one's from Texas, and one's from Florida, and one's from New York, and one's from Chicago, and a couple are from LA, you got a national organization.
Yeah.
So I said, that seems more doable than the other thing. So we issued a national press release in hopes that people would actually respond to us.
Yeah.
So we created this press release, and I remember to this day, it said, the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals was formed today in San Diego, California, to represent the interests of the 50,000 Hispanics employed in the housing industry. Where did we get the number 50,000?
Where did you?
We just made it up. It sounded big enough to be impressive,
to be important,
but not too big to where it sounded absurd, right? And so we put that 50,000. Believe it or not, that number got published about 100 times over the next 4 years, from the Wall Street Journal to the Realtor.com, and like it was the gospel truth, like there was some science behind it. And so that's what the press release said, and people started to email and call us, and they would say, hey, this is really cool. I'd love to be a part of it. Well, who are you? Oh, my name's Tony Ruano. I live in Miami. What do you do? I'm a real estate broker. I have two offices, and I write a column for the Miami Herald for Hispanics looking to buy a home. Awesome. Do you want to be on the national board? I wish I was making it up, but that was an actual conversation that took place. So fast forward 15 conversations like that, and we actually had a national board from all over the country. And Ernie, my co-founder, who passed away 3 years ago, by the way, he was a product of the political world. He used to serve in, you know, he was a staffer for a member of Congress back in the day. He was a political animal. And he said, Gary, he tells me this, well, we're already halfway into this. He says, we're not qualified to do this. And I said, Ernie, I don't think we can go back now. You know, how do we fix that? And he says, well, we don't have the credentials. And when you don't have the credentials, you need to get somebody to endorse you, right? Like a political candidate who endorsed you, right? And I said, so somebody who is qualified, I take it, would have the authority to endorse us. And he said, yeah. So we sat there in the conference room. Who could that be? And we wrote a bunch of names. And one of the names we put on there on the wall was Henry Cisneros. And Henry Cisneros, this is back in 1999, had recently been the secretary of HUD for Bill Clinton. So he was the first Latino to hold that position. That's a member of the president's cabinet. So who knows Henry Cisneros? Mm-hmm. No, but we didn't know anybody who knew Henry Cisneros. And so we decided to write him a letter cold. Just write him a letter
cold.
Just
write him a letter.
Yeah, at the time he was the president of Univision, which is up here in LA.
And Univision.
So, Univision.
Okay, good.
And so we wrote him a letter and said, hey, you know, we started this organization called NAREP. Here's our mission statement, which is to advance the cause of Hispanic homeownership. We would love any advice you can give us, any guidance, you know, and so forth. Basically, in a nutshell, that was the letter. Lo and behold, he wrote back. He wrote back and he said, I think this is a great idea. I wish NARAP had existed when I was HUD secretary because we could have done some partnerships together and whatnot. But if there's ever anything I can do to help you guys, just let me know. I said, did you see that? He says, ever anything he can do to help us. So it came on letterhead. It had a phone number in the bottom of the letterhead. So I said, we have to call him and have him be the keynote speaker at our first kickoff event.
First event.
If Henry Cisneros is the keynote speaker at our first event, we're done.
That's what we need.
We're real. Right, we're legit. So we called the number up, and his assistant answered the phone, and we said, hey, we just got this letter from Henry, and he offered to help us. We're wondering if he could be the keynote speaker at our first event in LA. And she said, well, I can ask him. She says, when is the event? Give me the details. Now, we already had a date. We already had a venue, everything already in place. But at that moment, I thought, like, the whole conversation had gone through my head. I said, we're going to give her that date, and she's going to say he's not available, and that's going to be the end of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So she's
so already, all this happened you in a split
second in my mind. So yeah. She said, when is the event? I said, and this was the dumbest thing that could come out of my mouth. I said, it's whenever he can make it. And as I said that, I thought, I must sound like an absolute idiot. And she said, okay, I'll get back to you. And I thought, man, people must say dumb things like that all the time to them. So she called us back the next day and said, he's available March 1st and June 18th and whatever. And I said, we'll take March 1st. And we literally built the event around his availability and then issued a second press release saying Henry Cisneros will keynote NARAP's inaugural event in L.A., and with that second email, all of a sudden, people were flying in from Washington, D.C., from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, people who I couldn't get on the phone, you know,
right.
Being in the business for 10 years,
right.
All of a sudden wanted to see what this thing was all about. And that's how we got it off the ground.
That is, give him a round of applause. That is awesome, right? You know, guys, how many of you guys can raise your hands and say, there was a lot of lessons in that, just in that little, like, I mean, I'm learning as he's speaking, right? So Gary, look, obviously since then, the thing has just exploded.
Yeah, it started to grow. In fact, I'll say this, Danny, I don't want to take much time, but, you know, for the first 5 years of the organization, it was like a rocket ship. I mean, it seemed like, you know, the timing was right. You know, there was census information that came out in 2000 that said that Hispanics were now the number one minority in this country. It was always African-American. It was 2000 when that changed. And so all of a sudden, companies were interested in the Hispanic market. They were looking at it differently, more strategically than anything else. Governments were looking at it. You know, members of Congress said, hey, I might need the Hispanic vote if I want to win in my district and so forth. So the timing was really great in that regard. And it seemed like, you know, we could do no wrong for the first 5 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of it was just external circumstances. We were lucky. The timing was right, like I said. But then the market crashed.
Right.
Right? So this is like 2000. Now we're getting to 2006, 2007. The wheels are starting to fall off. 2008 is a full-blown collapse.
Yeah.
And things that we said that could never happen.
Happened.
Were happening like every day. Fannie Mae is gone. Washington Mutual is gone. Fannie and Freddie are seized by the federal government. These are all companies that provided us with financial support.
Right, right, right.
And so our budget, which was at the time probably about $2.5 million, went from $2.5 million to $500,000.
Wow.
And we had a Washington, D.C. office, and we had to shut it down. Mm-hmm. And we had to move everything back to San Diego, mm-hmm. what was close to Ernie and I. And we said, okay, we got to, you know, figure a way to reorganize and maybe think about really what this organization should be all about.
Mm.
And because as tough as it was for NARAP, because a lot of people went through tough times during that period of time, it was devastating to see what was happening to our members.
Mm.
I mean, people had started businesses and were losing those businesses. They were losing their homes. They were losing their families. I mean, this is not that long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, we like to forget what happened 10 years ago, but this was the low watermark, perhaps, of the century economically in this country. And I remember one story, I've told this story many times. I got a call from one of our members from Ventura who said, hey, Gary, can you help me out? She said, I have a family member who is about to lose their home. And the sale date is next week, and Citi mortgage was the servicer, and they couldn't get the right person on the phone because the family had rallied together to come up with the money to save the home. And I said, I don't understand the problem.
If you have the money. Right.
They said, they won't talk to us because the borrower, the person who was on the note, had committed suicide. He killed himself out of the shame of losing the home and losing, you know, the security for his family and all those things. And that was just, you know, people, these stories actually happened during that period of time. And fortunately, I did have a contact at City Mortgage because of NAREP, and they were able to resolve the situation for the family. But about 2 weeks after that, I called up Henry Cisneros again, and I said, we have to change what NAREP's all about, because, you know, it can't just be about, you know, getting people together and figuring out how to close more transactions and so forth. It has to be about something deeper than that. And we had recently read a story that said that during the crisis, the trough of the crisis, that Hispanic household wealth in America had dropped by 67%. Two-thirds of the wealth that the Hispanic families in this country held during the crisis disappeared. And that really pushed us towards what we now call the Hispanic Wealth Project.
The Wealth Project, right.
And the NAREP 10, and these principles that now guide the organization that are much more deep, much more sustainable, and resonate with people in a much more powerful way. And what you're doing right now, Danny Morrell, whether you realize it or not, is a powerful engine to making that a reality. So
I appreciate that.
Thank you. That's why I'm here.
I appreciate that, Gary. So a question. Wonderful business people, great families, all have vision, all want to grow, all want to do better, and whether we realize it or not, all essentially want to do what you did, which was, you know, start with a vision in mind and grow something special, grow something maybe not national, maybe local. It doesn't matter,
sure.
But the rules apply, right?
Right.
Would you guys agree the rules apply, you know? Step number one, what would it be?
Well, you know, I'm kind of an action person. Right? Somebody told me once that I'm a guy that shoots and then aims. Mm. And, you know, that's not how most people do things.
Correct.
But for whatever reason, it's worked for me.
Yeah.
And so I will take action before I've thought out all of the possible scenarios that may or may not work. I won't wait. And I do subscribe to the notion that a good idea today is better than a perfect idea tomorrow, right? So taking that first step to me and taking action is critical, right?
Does that sound a little bit like the sauna story? Isn't it the same? I was just telling them, like, I recently heard a sermon, which you need to get a sauna, by the way, an infrared sauna. I just heard a story that was a pastor that essentially cured himself of cancer. And
I caught the tail end of that.
Oh,
yeah.
You saw that. And it was like, it was just so amazing. Like, no one takes action.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think stops people from taking action?
Well, I think fear. I think people are so influenced by external influences around them. You know, the people around us, you know, unless we've been very selective, you know, they don't necessarily want to see you do better than they are doing.
Hold on.
Right?
Hold on. What did you say? You're striking a chord right now here.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that the people around you, unless you've been very selective about picking those people and the time you spend with them, you know, they want you to do well, but not better than they are doing. You know, it's human nature. You know, so people will tell you 100 reasons why you can't do what it is that you've set out to do. You know, there's no shortage of that. So I think that's a big, you know, the outside influences are generally negative. And I think that's one reason why people don't take action. I think we have this fear of failure.
Yeah.
You know, it's you've heard it many times, and people say, you got to love failing, you got to fail forward and all these types of things. It's really true.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you've got to recognize that there's a pretty good chance you're going to fail. And it's really the resilience and perseverance that makes it a success at the end of the day. You know, if I had the choice of being, you know, a genius or being somebody who was relentless, I would choose relentless all day long.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you need your motivators, right? Right. So I look, I used to carry this photograph of my two kids, my two youngest kids, when I would go, when we started the organization, you know, I was learning it as I went. You know, I didn't think about some of the areas that I'd end up in a very short period of time, testifying in front of the United States Congress on issues related to small businesses and issues related to housing. Mm-hmm. You know, so you've seen the guys testifying there with the, you know, the table and the congressman right. peppering them with questions, sometimes right. trying to make them look bad. I did that, you know, 2 years after I started the organization, you know, and I used to be a little bit afraid of that. Yeah. You know, it's like, I'm not ready for this. You know, like I was a mortgage broker 2 years ago. What am I doing walking into the United States
Congress yeah.
and I'm going to tell them something they don't know.
Yeah.
But I used to carry this picture of my kids, you know, and they had this great smile on their face and they were so innocent. And I used to think if they were sitting in the front row of this situation, I would have no choice but to do really well.
Do really well, yeah. Yeah.
And that would kind of, you know, that would keep me home, you know, and those little things kind of worked for me. So my motivation was my family, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
my kids wanting to be a good example for them,
right.
Trying to, you know, do something that they could be proud of down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, take action. Forget all of the external negative influences in your life and find your motivators.
I love it. I love it. It's, you know, I have a picture like that too. It's yeah. literally on my screen. It's everywhere. It's my kids in an ice chest. Because it just reminds me of like when we literally had no money and it was so hot.
I remember that picture.
Remember that?
And my picture was similar because was my kids were, it was a picture that we took before Christmas and it wasn't a great Christmas that year.
See, isn't that crazy?
It wasn't, and they have this so innocent look in their face, you
yeah.
know? They don't know that the world was collapsing no. around us, you know, and that Christmas was really hard that year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were just, you know, kids, you
Being
know,
kids, yeah.
looking forward to Christmas. Man, that really hit home for me.
Yeah, that is, yeah. Gary, I know you, but I'm just feeling, I'm literally like either you reincarnated or me. I don't know. There's something going, I mean, literally to the picture, to the only thing is, and I don't want to help people understand this. You did say one thing that I never had. I never had. Not that I never had a family that told me or convinced. No, I never had that.
Yep.
I honestly got my family dynamic, guys, was so weird. It was so weird because, like, number one, when we got divorced, when my mom and dad got divorced, my mom, single mom, literally 4'2", brought us over here. At the time, I'm 11 or 12. Anthony is 1 or 2, and my brother Omar is 8 or 9 or so. And, you know, I'll never forget this. At that time, we literally, from my dad, we just, like, separated. Like, it was like a brick wall. It just kind of went up, right?
Wow.
And my mom was never really, like, aggressive enough to go out and make it happen. And I clearly remember this, guys. I remember being 6.
It was survival.
It was literally, like, mom wasn't going to do it. She just, it wasn't going to happen. So if it was going to happen, like, you look around and somebody had to make it happen, and it was like, I guess that's me. I guess I'll make it happen. To the point, Gary, that you're going to laugh at this, but I was 13 or 14 years old when we realized, like, there are no trains here in California. So my mom was used to traveling on the train. She could get around. She didn't know how to drive. She didn't know how to drive. My first sale ever was convincing her to go buy a car, and she bought a stick shift. A Hyundai Excel. Well, anybody ever remember learning how to drive? Would you ever learn how to drive with a stick shift? No, you start with an automatic, right? So guess what happened? On top of that, my mom is real timid. She was really timid, very reserved, right? So, you know, when the street is like this, if the car starts going backward, the clutch fires and the car turns off, forget about it. She would just get nervous. So I drove our family around at 13. I was the driver from 13 until the cops finally found out, and then I got scared and I couldn't do that anymore, right? But I'm saying that because I didn't have somebody to convince me that anything was possible.
Yep.
On the contrary, my mom wasn't like my mom, as weird as this sounds. We were like husband and wife almost, because we ran the household together, you know? For somebody that doesn't have or didn't have somebody to show them that anything was possible, can they still make it happen? And if so, how?
No question about it. No question about it. You know, I'll share something, you know, very personal. And that is, you know, my father, My father grew up in a very poor, not a great environment. You know, there was a lot of negativity around him when he grew up. Drugs, prison. You know, these were family members of his. And, you know, he used to come home and when he was a boy, and he would find an uncle passed out because he was, you know, he had just taken heroin. And this is, you know, a 7-8-year-old boy having to encounter that. And my father never drank alcohol his entire life, you know, to this day. He's 75 years old, healthy, thank God. And so he's a perfect example of somebody who came from huge adversity. But his mindset was always, so you can learn from your environment both what you want to become and what you don't want to become, right? And for my dad, it was the lessons he learned as a young boy were very powerful in the sense he knew what he didn't want to become.
Wow.
Right? And so I know I use alcohol as just an example of that. The thought of him drinking alcohol resonated to that childhood where he saw people drunk and high and stuff like that. And he got as far away from that as he possibly could. And he surrounded himself with people who, you know, had the kind of environments that he desired. Which is what my mom was to him. So my mom, you know, wasn't wealthy, but my grandfather was a Pentecostal preacher, a pastor of a church. Mm-hmm. So she had the completely opposite upbringing than
structure,
he did.
Structure, love, discipline,
faith, all these things that he desired. You know, fortunately for me, they fell in love.
Yeah, and here you are.
And here I am. But, you know, not everybody had it as rough as my dad did. But it's an example of how you can use even negative influences to motivate you in a positive way.
And I think, you know, more than anything, guys, you know, if you're learning anything at this event is that, you know, number one, your past doesn't dictate your future. And number two, you can make a choice. You know, you get like your dad literally made the decision. Like, you know, when by the way, when you're that young, you can't make the decision. It is what it is. You're stuck where you are, right? But I can pretty much imagine him at 16, 17, or 18. He probably just uprooted, moved, and just started surrounding himself with better people.
Yeah, you know? And you know, he had cousins and whatnot that grew up in the same environment that went down the same path.
The same path.
You know, so you do have a choice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Are you guys loving this? I can do this for like the next, I can do this for like the next week. And I'm going to tell you why. I'm just a believer that when you have great people around you that are doing great things, like you just pull up a chair and you just ask questions because I just want to soak it all up and learn as much as possible because it just shows a great example, right? I got another one for you because if I want empire to stand for anything, it's that you can have balance. You know, you can have balance. Uh-huh. You know, you really can be a success in the business world, and at the same time, you can be a success at home. How do you find that balance?
You know, that's a great question. To me, it's not a choice. You know, I'm passionate about my family. Yeah, you know, I'm going to my son's basketball game. I haven't missed one yet this year. I'm present in my family's life. Mm-hmm. It gives me all of the motivation and all of the, you know, just quality of life that I seek out more than anything else. So balance, you know, it's not like I have to consciously say, you know, this is what I have to do to balance my family and my business and, you know, anything else that I might be interested in. It sort of happens naturally. You absolutely, in my view, I guess my point is that it's not something that I recommend. It's something that is essential. Mm. It's essential because eventually, if you're all business all the time and you neglect everything else in your life, you are going to sputter out. You're going to find yourself at some point depressed and unfulfilled, and it's going to affect your business in a negative way. You have to have both. It doesn't have to be, you know, the traditional family.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to have, you know, that balance in your life to where you have things that are more important to you than yourself.
I love it.
And that's huge.
I love it. I'm sure some of you guys have some questions. Any questions? Questions? Yeah. And I'll throw it to you.
This is one of those microphone pillows or whatever.
And I am, wait, and you guys don't think I can do it overhand. And I can do it overhand. And I'll put that back on later. Oh, I can't do it overhand. Okay.
Nice.
Go for it, Christian.
You mentioned having some ups and downs growing the business. How did you keep your mindset positive the entire time?
Well, you know, somebody once said that failure is not an option, right? And failure is a reality. It is an essential part of success, but accepting failure is probably a better way to characterize it, is not an option. And so for me, you know, it was never an option just to say, that didn't work out, I'm moving on. Now, you may have to pivot at times, you know, and you may have to say, okay, the path I'm going down from a business standpoint is not the one that's going to take me where I want to go, and I need to pivot that and go in a different direction. It was one of the toughest things in business, quite frankly, knowing when to persevere and when to pivot, right? And sometimes you pull the trigger too quickly, and sometimes it's too late. But the option of folding the tent and going home was never one that was a consideration.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Did I answer your question? Yeah?
Yeah.
Awesome. Who else? Questions? And Christian, if you wouldn't mind, just tossing it over.
This question is for both of you. Earlier, Danny, you had mentioned that there might be a downfall in the economy or real estate. And what is NAREP doing about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Okay, so what is the question?
Well, see the economy going.
It's not what I see the economy doing. It's what you can kind of look back and see the economy has done. I think that's what's most important, right? I don't feel like I can remember back in 2005, 2006, 2007, in hindsight, if you were to be able to look out, I didn't have the wherewithal to do this, but in hindsight, you could have been able to see, there's something that's about to happen here right now. You know, the only thing that I could see right now is we have massive amounts of debt, right? Trillions of dollars of debt and notes that, quite frankly, cannot be paid. And people say that there could be a catastrophe. I honestly believe most of those people are trying to sell you on something. I think that in 2019, later half, there's going to be some sort of a correction. And I think it'll last 2 to 3 quarters. That's what I think, or at least that's what I believe. But I don't have a crystal ball.
It's not an exact science, you know, but Danny's exactly right. There are signals out there that we're due for a correction. Our economy is cyclical to a certain degree. Most of us here in the room are in the housing business, also a very cyclical business. So it tends to have these kind of uptrends and then has these sort of corrections or downtrends. We're due for a downtrend. Interest rates are starting to eke up. We're dealing with inventory challenges in the marketplace. There's a lot of fundamentals out there that lead us to believe that that could happen. What is NAREP doing about it? Well, 2 years ago, we released what we call the NAREP 10, which are these principles and disciplines that we think all members should subscribe to. And one of them says very clearly that prepare for a recession because they are a normal part of economic cycles. It is core. For whatever reason, being in the real estate business attracts people who are by nature optimists.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to be an optimist to be a good salesperson, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes that optimism works against us because we think what's happening today is going to continue in perpetuity. And the reality is not. So you have to be very frugal with your money. We're a big advocate towards reducing debt. Debt is the
That's
anchor
the killer. That's the
that'll
one.
Kill
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
You know, you think about anybody who's, you can't file bankruptcy if you don't have debt.
If you don't have debt, right.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so reducing debt as quickly as you can is really a core principle that people who understand money, understand wealth, they get that. They know you got to avoid debt as much as possible. So reducing debt, saving money, investing in things that are stable, that may go down like real estate, but not down to zero, will help you weather the storm and perhaps even put you in a position to succeed even further when those around you haven't prepared. and are selling things cheap, like real estate and like their businesses and so forth. So so read those disciplines, be frugal, and keep your debt low.
Thank you.
Can I share two with you? Some of you have heard me say this before, but Claudia and I took a class called Financial Peace University. Mm. And if you have never taken that class, guys, I highly, highly recommend it. Since then, I'm happy to say, not only do we not have debt, but we don't own any real estate where we owe more than 50% on the properties. And I'll even take it a step further. If you look at our portfolio in complete, we only owe 35% or so on the overall
against the assets.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way to be.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something else. And the other thing is, honestly, guys, and this is why I believe so much in what we're doing. The biggest thing you can do is increase your revenue. Increase your revenue, right? I taught you guys how to do that earlier in so many different ways. Increase your revenue and then just be smart about what to do with that revenue when it comes in.
Increase your revenue and just try not to increase your expenses proportionately.
Yeah.
I have a friend by the name of Foster Standback, and he's been a mentor to me for the Hispanic Wealth Project. He's a gringo, but he's married to a gal from Mexico City, so he's got a Latino sort of passion in his heart. This sounds like an old wives' tale, like something I made up, but it's true. His father was Warren Buffett's best roommate in college and was the best man in his wedding. So they have that relationship that goes back years. Foster is, if he was sitting here right next to us, you might want to, you know, feel like you have to buy him lunch.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he just his mindset, what I describe him as having an evolved mindset when it comes to wealth and prosperity. Mm. He's way beyond the superficial. Mm. He doesn't measure wealth the same way most people do.
How old is he?
52, 53. Awesome. I could tell you, last year he gave $7 million to Caltech to provide scholarships for low to moderate income kids. He's a philanthropist out now on a full-time basis. He manages the family fortune, which is in excess of $1 billion.
Wow.
I'll tell you this much, just to give you a sense of how wealthy he is. His father invested $250,000 in Berkshire Hathaway in 1958.
What's so, that worth? That's...
Oh, it's 20? You know, it's like a $500 million, yeah, just that stake alone.
Louise.
Yeah, so it's remarkable what they built. But, you know, his whole mindset and the way he lives his life, he lives what he describes as a clutter-free life. It's clutter-free. He says, I want to be able to get up and do what I want to do. I don't want to worry about things. I don't have 10 houses because then I have to maintain 10 houses.
Oh, so he's like
that's
that.
What he thinks, right?
I got you.
I go want a house. If I want to go anywhere in the world, I can rent a house for a month and I can stay there and I'm fine.
Yeah.
He's liquid. Yeah. You know, he's got his money in the market. He knows how to do that. He invests, very intelligently. He does not have a money manager. He manages it himself. He believes everybody has the capacity to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You don't need to give, 10% of your money to a money manager. It's been a remarkable education being around people like that. And they're out there. They're out there.
And they want to help. Yeah.
You know, the problem is people don't want to listen to them.
Could you see if he would come to Relentless in July?
I will talk to him.
Are you guys up for that? Yeah, that would be freaking awesome, right? Yeah. Just see.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He will. I'll connect you to him before then,
okay,
and then
cool.
You kind of get to know him a little bit.
Okay,
that'd be great.
That would be awesome.
Yeah,
that would be awesome. Good. Yes. Questions? Two more. Yeah. Go ahead and just toss it over.
Okay. I have a question for both of you. You guys started very young, and I like to really know how you guys kept your momentum going through those hard times, and you guys never stopped to reach your full potential.
You see, I did stop. And that's okay. See, I'm so glad you brought this up, guys, because
he was my basketball.
Thought is, look at them. They did it, and how come I'm not doing it? And there's this like separation gap that we do in our own minds with people. And I'm here to let you know, you probably just could be in that time where I was, where things aren't flowing exactly the way you wish that they would be flowing. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah? here's the one thing I have never done. I have never, ever stopped showing up. I have never, ever stopped dreaming. I have never, ever stopped believing. I have never, ever, sometimes I can't even sleep just because I'm constantly thinking about the future that much. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
So
yeah.
It's like sometimes, yeah, sometimes like you get beat up, right? But even in the midst of being up, like, I mean, just this, we were here 10 years ago in this room, and literally the market fell apart, and I went broke, but I never stopped dreaming of being back. And if anything, I could have picked any other hotel. And I always play games like this with myself. I don't know if you guys do. I could have picked any hotel. There was a reason why I picked this one. Because for me, I wanted that story that, Elias, what did you use? What word did you use earlier? The evidence. This is evidence to me that nothing's going to stop me. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
And please learn from this, people, because this also could have been evidence of a different sort. This could have been a reminder of a negative time, right? But instead, I made it now a reminder of the beginning of something new. Mm-hmm. And you have the choice and power to do that too.
I will say this, okay, this is an interesting metaphor. So my son plays high school basketball, and he's a really good three-point shooter. He's a good offensive player. And in the beginning of the season, he started off in a slump.
Uh-huh.
He was expecting to have just this incredible year, and he started off poorly. Couldn't hit the side of a barn. And I said, look, son, I said, here's what you have to, the way you have to look at this. And this is really hard. Really hard, especially for somebody as young as you. I said, you are going to shoot 50% from the field. You're going to make half of the shots that you shoot. You're going to make 40% of the three-point shots. You're going to make 80% of your free throws. Now, it doesn't mean that every 10 that you shoot, you're going to make 8. But over the span of the year, you're going to have that. So you're going to have days where you can't make anything, and you're going to have days where you can't miss anything. But you have to have absolute confidence. Supreme confidence, unshakable confidence, that you know at the end of the day, you're going to shoot 50% of the field. That's better than 99% of the competition that's out there. And you have to be relentless in your pursuit of what it is that you want to accomplish. And I can tell you right now, he's shooting 51% from the field right now, 39% from three-point line. I told him 40. He's shooting 39%, and he's shooting 85% from the free throw line. And he's had bad games and good games. And so it's a very small metaphor. But for a 17-year-old kid, to have a game that's really bad, it can be very depressing, it can get in his head, and it could affect the way he plays his whole season, it's important that he has the mental toughness to fight his way through that. And I think the same thing applies to business. You have to recognize that there's going to be peaks and valleys. It's part of the game.
It is.
It's actually the part that makes it all worthwhile.
Yes.
Because if it was easy all the time, we wouldn't appreciate the success as much as we do when we do succeed.
Right. Yes.
Thank you.
Can I help you with something?
Yeah.
If you've learned anything, have you learned like the theme of not beating yourself up? People, listen to me, if I can. I remember the year I did 150 deals. That's a lot of business. I think what got me to those 150 deals is that I would take those breaks to go see Anthony's games. Because that would allow me just a little bit of
your
a
brother.
Break. My brother.
Baseball player.
Yeah, my baseball player. And I would never miss those games. And I also remember on the days that I didn't feel like it, you know, there were some that I'll be honest, it's very rare that I don't feel like it. I always feel like working. But sometimes on the days that I don't, I'll just check out and I'll go watch a movie by myself and I'll go hang out and maybe go have a glass of wine and just kind of relax. And you guys are not going to believe this. And if I don't feel like it the second day, I probably won't go to work again for the second day. But on the third day, I don't make a negative meaning about the last 2 days. That's the difference. Hmm. The difference is that I have grace with myself. I'm a human binchi being. I'm not a robot, and neither are you. The only difference, my friends, is my relationship with hitting the pause button or failing or messing up, it's not that big of a deal to me. As a matter of fact, I see it differently. I see it like, oh yeah, all right, watch next time. And next time doesn't have to be the very next day. I've told many of you guys that coach with us before, you know, there are times where you've got to know, like, you know what? I'd rather, if you don't feel like it, I'd rather you not go and infect your office with that. I'd rather you go hang out for a couple days, but come back on Monday. Come back on Monday and hit it hard on Monday. When my mom passed away, you think I felt like it? Who was around me during that time? Did we skip a beat? We didn't skip a beat. I gave myself a period of time. I remember, I think she passed away like on a Tuesday. Family's flying in, so forth and so on. I'm obviously grieving. I obviously feel terrible. And I told myself, okay, Danny, you have till Sunday. And from Tuesday through Sunday, I did nothing business related. And the beautiful thing is that everybody in Terrell was obviously supportive of that. And they came to the funeral and everything because they all get it. And you guys will hear me say this in the company, won't you? Hey, guys, I need a little bit of your patience for the next 2 to 3 days because this and this is going on. And then guess what? I don't care who makes a meaning about that. To me, it just means I need a little bit of a break. But on that final day, on that Monday, I'm going to come back harder than ever. And I give myself that grace. And I don't know, I really feel like God blesses that maturity. Because I think there's immaturity with beating yourself up over something that means nothing in the long term. Does that make sense?
It does. So, thank you.
Yeah.
Good? Awesome, awesome.
That was me seeking approval from my mentor. You saw that, right? I caught that right now. I caught that. I was like, Gary, what'd you think? Yeah, good, okay, good. All right, good. We're good. We're good. Final questions for Gary. Lee. By the way, Gary, you have got to meet Lee Barrison. Have you ever met Lee Barrison?
Yes, you do, Gary.
No, looking forward to it.
Lee Barrison, I love this guy. I love this guy. Lee Barrison dances.
I can't wait.
Wait. Lee Barrison, hold on. Hold on. Lee is more Hispanic than I am.
That's big.
Yo no soy haciendo mendidas, señor.
Yes. Lee dances quebraditas. His wallet is like a huaracha wallet. He eats more Mexican food than, and he trips me out. This is the awesomest human being on planet Earth. You gotta meet this guy.
Thanks. Thanks, Danny.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a question for you, Gary. My wife and I have three beautiful kids.
Awesome.
And I feel it's my duty and my obligation to them to convince them that anything in life is possible. And so I guess, you know, you kind of vaguely touched that there was no rhyme or reason how you were convinced, but what specifically convinced you to understand that there was nothing was possible in this world?
That your parent, that his parents did?
Yes, yeah.
So I remember, you know, conversations with my parents growing up, especially my mom. And my mom was the driver in the household, you know, in terms of the firmness. And so first of all, you know, they, as I was younger, you know, they would tell me, you know, you're gonna do great things. You know, Gary, you're smart. As I got older, it changed to more of, Gary, you know better than that. You know, and the thing is, I remember from very beginning is that my parents always talked to me like an adult. They always reasoned with me. They were firm. When they didn't like what I said or what I was doing or whatever, my mom would just say, you know, you have a grandmother that's praying for you every day, Gary. You know better than this. You know? And she was right. I did know better. And, you know, it's hard. You can't argue with that. But she used to, and so, you know, she held me to a higher standard. It wasn't an unreasonable standard. It wasn't one to where if I, you know, got a B that, you know, the world was going to end. But she would reason with me and say, why? Did you do your best? I don't think so. You know, and, you know, Gary, if this was, you know, anybody else, maybe they'd be happy with this report card, but I know you, and I know this isn't the best you can do, and so it's not acceptable. And so, you know, it was a series of conversations like that where, again, you know, my mom, at some point, there was a tipping point where she convinced me that, yeah, all right, I should be doing something important with my life. And there's no reason why I shouldn't be able to achieve that. You know, it just kind of clicked.
Awesome.
That's beautiful. Gary.
Hey, guys.
Gary, I've got one more question, or not question, but statement. My good friends Moses and Maria Rosales and myself just opened up, in a group of us, just brought NARUP to Bakersfield, California. So,
oh, awesome.
Thank you.
That's great
absolutely.
News. That's great
awesome.
News. So I want to say one thing before we wrap up, and that is, you know, Danny, you're definitely not a person that needs a whole lot of encouragement.
You're always so nice.
I mean, it's true. I mean, so I say this with a great degree of humility, but you know that I was one of the guys behind the scenes saying, hey, Danny, you know, because I'd see him post stuff on social media and, you know, whether it was, you know, Mike Ferry, whoever else that was there.
He's been telling me for like 5 years.
And I sent him a note that says, you know, these guys can't hold a candle to you. You know, they're not in your league, you know, and I would tell him that because it was true. He had a plan. Let me be clear about that and give him the benefit of that. He had a plan, and he had a particular path in mind that he knew he had to pursue to be where he is right now. But I can just tell you, I'm so grateful that you are where you are right now, because this is where you belong.
I appreciate it, yeah. Hey, give Gary a round of applause, guys.
Thank you, guys. Love you,
bro. Love you too, man. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, right? Come on, give him a round of applause.